Don't forget to read the small print. It's time for another Flat Chat. And this month's GP Racing celebrates the 30th anniversary of Michael Schumacher's Formula One debut for Jordan, followed by an unseemly bout of contractual smash and grab. And joining me to count the cash in the suitcase and look back at the year Bryan Adams was number one all summer are Mark Gallagher.
Good to be here. Nice to be talking about those days 30 years ago when Michael burst upon the scene.
Those Halicon days, as a chap in a university seminar said at the time, which woke me up. It was quite an early seminar. Giggling away in the background, it's for the first and last time during this podcast, my pun star, it's Ben Anderson.
Hello. Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. We have a living legend, someone who lived that legend with us today, don't we? So I'm looking forward to hearing Mark's.
Oh, was that? Sorry, is that me?
That's you. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I was wondering who the fourth participant was.
I'm reintroducing you as the star of this podcast.
Gosh.
Whether you're counting or carrying the cash, though, has yet to be determined.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and, you know, cash in suitcases always involved in some, well, they always often involved in some transactions.
Careful.
Back in the day. Yes.
Particularly back then. Yes.
Yeah, we are looking back at a time when there were lots of funny Italian teams that needed to get sponsors money out of the country and then disappear sharpish soon afterwards.
Also Irish teams. Don't leave the Irish teams out of it.
Reverse. So yeah, 1991. Listeners to the podcast can, of course, go back to 1991 in more ways than just this, because obviously on BBC4 at the moment, Top of the Pops 1991 is currently, I think, mid-July. So Bryan Adams has just knocked, I believe, Jason Donovan off the number one slot. And there he will remain right up until the 25th of August and beyond, when Michael Schumacher made his Grand Prix debut. Back then, Mark was definitely earning his salary because he was Jordan's press officer, no doubt having to get EJ out of trouble on more than one occasion. And Mark, you've contributed one of our headline features this month, which is the behind-the-scenes look at Michael's debut in the Belgian Grand Prix, which does involve some cash, not necessarily in a suitcase.
It's interesting, isn't it, whenever people talk about paid drivers, you don't immediately think of Michael Schumacher as a paid driver. But that, of course, exactly what he was on his debut for our team back then. And, yeah, I mean, the feature was, I mean, I have to thank you, Ben, for giving me the room to write about that turn of events that time in Jordan's. Yeah, it was great. It was actually great fun. And to put the piece together, I thought, well, you know, I can reminisce about my own experiences. But I sat down with Trevor Foster, who was at that time the race engineer for Michael, as well as being team manager. This is back in the day where everyone who worked in the small Formula One team had four jobs to do.
What were your other jobs, Mark, as well as being a press officer?
my other jobs were taking abuse from Eddie Jordan.
lots of that.
Receiving abuse from Eddie Jordan and not being paid by Eddie Jordan. So contrary.
Checks in the post.
Contrary.
So you weren't earning your salary then, contrary to your introduction.
So, I mean, it's actually very amusing that the very notion that I was earning a salary from Eddie Jordan. I mean, my goodness, you know, that's actually, I'll very quickly tell you the story about that, because Eddie couldn't afford to have a media service in 1991. He couldn't afford to have press officers or, you know, PR people and whatever running around. So he said to me, look, I really want you to do the job, but you'll have to find someone to pay you. So I, so in, you know, he's being an entrepreneur, he doesn't want to spend any money. And what we actually did was we convinced Fujifilm, who were a sponsor, everybody thinks about 7-Up, but Fujifilm were on the rear wing of the car, and Fujifilm actually paid my salary direct, and the press service was effectively sponsored by Fujifilm. And then on top of that, Eddie was due to pay me money for what should have effectively been the second part of my salary. So Fujifilm were kind of guaranteeing the basic minimum, as it were. At the end of the year, Eddie hadn't paid a single invoice that I had sent into the team. And I was chasing him quite hard. So he So he said, yeah, I'll sort that out. Anyway, about 2 days later, a letter, an envelope arrived from Jordan, and I thought, wow, this is great. Got my check from Eddie, and I opened it up, and there was an invoice. And the invoice was the invoice was for almost exactly the same amount of money that I had billed the team for their press services. And he had invoiced me for having eaten breakfast, lunch, and dinner in his motorhome for all 16 rounds of the Formula One World Championship. And as a rather naive young chap, I absolutely exploded when I received this, and I was furious, and I drove to Silverstone to see him, and we sat down, and he had such a big smile on his face when I confronted him. And all I will say is he did settle, and I didn't quite get the amount that I had billed him, but I realized that the team didn't have a lot of money. And actually, to be, you know, that's, I suppose, the final punchline to that story is that some years later, when I joined the management board at Jordan, I discovered how much debt the team was in at the end of 1991. And frankly, the fact that he paid me at all was a miracle. And it's hard to explain the degree to which he absolutely put everything on the table to make that team work. And so I kind of look back on it not as anything other than Eddie was doing everything he could to survive and to keep the team on the track, and it was great to be part of it. And I'm just lucky that Fujifilm were around to help me pay my mortgage that year. But it was a great, it was a great experience. And then, of course, as I cover in the feature, you know, getting to that week, we'd had the Hungarian Grand Prix. We didn't have the formal summer break that we now have in Formula One, but it was still, you know, still August time.
Bertrand Gasho did.
Yeah, he sure did. But actually, you know, but we went into that summer break on a bit of a high because Bertrand had set a new lap record in Hungary, albeit it was because he had a puncture towards the end of the race, came in, put a new set of tires on, went out, low fuel time.
You know, that's very pressing, isn't it? Considering today's Formula One involves many drivers doing just that for a point.
Exactly. And that's what he did, new lap record. And so we went into the August break, really, on a bit of a high, even though we hadn't had a terrific result in Hungary, but we'd had that kind of little additional boost. And of course, everyone was looking forward to Spa, and it was Bertrand's home race, and we knew that he would have sponsors there, and obviously a lot of media attention from Belgian press. And then, of course, we get this absolutely cataclysmic turn of events, which no one saw coming. And I mean, I know Bertrand subsequently was fairly convinced that perhaps Eddie or the lawyer Fred Rogers had some hand in not, you know, making sure that he got off so that Eddie could put someone else in the car and get more money off them. But it was all terribly Machiavellian. But the reality is that I was there when the call came in. Eddie was completely devastated when he heard what had happened. We were totally disbelieving. And then, of course, to go through this whole cycle of trying to find a driver, and as I relate in the piece, you know, we had some quite unusual candidates for the drive, including Keke Rosberg, who had been out of Formula One for a few years, but was still racing in World Championship sports cars. And Eddie knew Keke, and there was a thought about having sort of the PR value of having Keke come back into the team and come back into Formula One. And of course, Keke had been a Marlboro driver, and we had a good relationship with Marlboro, both through Bertrand and with Andrea De Cesaris. And then, of course, we get this opportunity to put Michael Schumacher in the car, and Mercedes-Benz agree to pay a pretty substantial amount of money for one weekend. And when you consider $150,000, it doesn't sound like a lot of money. But as Trevor Foster relates to me in the piece, an engine rebuild for Jordan at the time was £30,000. So that puts into perspective, you know, $150,000 to us went quite a long way. And
how often were you having the engines rebuilt?
As often as Bertrand or Andrea missed a downshift. and you know, it's interesting, Trevor, I don't think I included this in the piece, because Trevor and I met to do this article for the magazine, and I think we allocated 45 minutes to have a chat. And in the end, we were thrown out of Silverstone Museum because we spent
personally by Stuart Pringle.
Someone was hoovering under your legs.
They literally came and said, "We're closing now. You need to leave," because we've been there all afternoon. But you know, Trevor was talking about the fact that with the H pattern manual gearbox and very small cockpits, it was incredibly easy for a driver to get a shift wrong. Cosworth just were not tolerant of buzzing the engine. So the moment you went over the rev limit, you were, you know, the engine was out of the car and you got a bill for 30 grand. So it was a pretty important point to the team by that stage, you know, towards the end of August. And we already had a pretty substantial overdraft and had a lot of suppliers that were owed money. So there was a lot of pressure on the team to get in whatever money it could and to have drivers who wouldn't screw up and who wouldn't do the wrong thing. And
how far did you get down the line with Keke? And was it just money that kiboshed that?
So it...
Because Trevor intimates that it got quite far and it was quite serious, but it's not elaborated on because obviously, you know, we can devote the whole magazine to this one story, unfortunately.
Sure, exactly. I mean, it got quite far down the road in that there were conversations about it. And Trevor, I mean, he points out that although he was team manager, you know, he was pretty anxious to know the details of who was likely to end up needing a seat fitting. And we actually had an incredibly short amount of time. We had about a week to get ready for the Belgian Grand Prix week. So, we didn't have much time. And so Trevor and Gary Anderson, who was effectively the other race engineer, chief designer, the two of them really wanted to know who were Eddie and Ian Phillips, who was effectively the commercial boss of the team, who were they going to put in the car. So the Keke conversation definitely got some legs, got moving. Obviously, he was a lot older. He was well into his 40s. I've been out of Formula One for a number of years. Eddie was quite keen on Stefan Johansson, but Stefan would have needed paying and that wasn't going to happen and he wouldn't be bringing any money with him. Mm. But, you know, that kind of shows how Eddie's mind worked, you know, that he would look at who do I know who can really bring value to the team. And he'd always invested in young drivers, and yet he also understood the benefit of having an experienced driver. And he really wouldn't have wanted to put someone in the car who was going to go straight out and shunt it or go straight out and over rev the engine. So when you get offered a driver who clearly has a lot of ability, which Michael had, and also brought with him a budget, that became a very easy decision to make.
But was it that easy? Because what I found really interesting about the Michael Schumacher story from another aspect is in the same issue, we've got Pat Simmons. And he writes a column about engineering with Michael subsequently when he went to Benetton, not to jump ahead too far.
Yeah.
But he talked about how at that team, they weren't really paying that much attention to Michael. They knew of him, but he wasn't somebody who was being talked about, you know.
Yeah,
we would imagine now that he was this guy that was inevitably going to arrive in Formula One. And, you know, as you see sometimes in the modern era, you know, there are these drivers that are picked out from a very early stage and you think, well, it's almost preordained they're going to end up.
Yeah,
you know, fighting at the front. But it didn't seem like that was the case with Michael. They were almost surprised by him at Benetton.
Yeah, I think everyone was surprised by the extent to which he just delivered straight away. And, of course, part of that was down to the fact that he stepped into a car that was very capable. And so he wasn't stepping into some no-hoper car at the back of the grid where he was going to struggle to show his ability. He was stepping into a car which Alain Prost famously said was the most impressive car to follow through a corner in that season. And, you know, it had a fabulous, huge diffuser, which worked incredibly well. It was not just an elegantly designed car, but from an aerodynamic point of view, was very efficient. It had some wind tunnel work done, some very short amount of wind tunnel time, but nevertheless, it had seen the inside of a wind tunnel, quite helpful. And
was it one day a week or something, one weekend a month?
Yeah, I mean, it was you know, University of Southampton wind tunnel, and I can't remember the details of the deal that Gary had struck with them. But, you know, also with Gary Anderson, you had a guy who was used to designing and manufacturing his own Formula 3 cars, the Anson Formula 3 cars that he had done. And so Gary understood everything that there was to know about designing, manufacturing, and bringing a car to completion, you know, to the racetrack. And so that three-man design team of himself, Andrew Green, and Mark Smith, you know, they did a remarkable job in bringing that car to fruition. And when Michael stepped in it, it was a car which had had the benefit of the team running it in Anger for not quite a year, 10 months. I mean, we did a shakedown test in October of the previous year. So by August, you know, we had quite a lot of mileage under our belt, and we'd had some very good results with that car, you know, most notably the fourth and fifth at the Canadian Grand Prix for Bertrand and Andrea. So, you know, so Michael, as a talent, got himself into a car where he could really show that talent, and on a track which definitely he loved. And yes, he hadn't raced it before, but he'd been there to watch races before. And as Trevor relates, I mean, he had the huge benefit of cycling two laps of the track beforehand. And, you know, as you know, Ben, in the feature, the, you know, Trevor talks about the fact that he had asked Andrea De Cesaris to show Michael how to drive Spa. Well, fortunately, that never happened.
Yeah, because by the time they were debriefing, Michael was telling him how to drive the circuit, yeah. Which I thought was what a brilliant anecdote from Trevor to emphasize the specialness that you had in the cockpit that weekend.
Well, I'm going to promote the magazine sale to anyone listening by saying you need to go and read what Trevor has to say about how Michael approached getting the speed that he did out of the Jordan 191, including in Andrea's car, because during first practice, there's a really nice story there. And actually, I it's one of those frustrating things. You have to decide what you include in a feature and what you have to exclude. And one of the things which I didn't manage to get into the feature, but I'll sort of mention, is that when they had those debriefs during the weekend, and Andrea was so annoyed that Michael was so much quicker than him, really significantly quick, not just like a tenth,
significant, was a chunk, wasn't it?
It was a decent chunk of time, like proper kind of, you know, what are you doing, Andrea? Difference in performance, and for Michael to just openly explain, well, of course, this is what I'm doing, and explaining the technique. And as Trevor describes, he developed that understanding of how to drive the car so quickly without anyone pointing it out to him. He effectively realized the way in which the diffuser needed to work and the way in which the car best needed to be driven in order to retain as much speed as possible. And, you know, Andrea in many respects is taking almost a late 1970s, early 80s approach to engineering a car. You know, it's all about springs and dampers and ride heights and, you know, wing settings. And Michael's taking a much more sophisticated approach, which I think was probably as well influenced by his experience of driving the big Sabre Mercedes sports cars, as well as his experience in single seater racing. So, you know, Michael was bringing all of his experience to bear on how do I get as much speed as possible out of this car, and then he really, really unlocked it. And Trevor, you know, told me that Andrea De Cesaris was absolutely convinced that there was a problem with his car.
We've heard that one before.
Wouldn't he? Yeah. How does a guy like that, who's the lead driver, compute the fact that some kid comes in, blows him away, who doesn't even know the circuit?
Yeah.
Nowadays, you'd offer him a new monocoque or something like that, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
you'd
exactly.
You'd have to appease him.
So that was the, you know.
I'm surprised he didn't retire on the spot.
When you're all listening to us talking about Formula One or watching it on TV and you're thinking, God, they're always talking about looking at the data. Well, of course, back in 1991, we really didn't have that much data. So you were terribly reliant on the driver for being truthful about what was actually happening.
And truthful, actually knowing.
So, you know, when you have Andrea De Cesaris coming in saying, oh, you know, I can't understand why I'm half a second off the pace. There's obviously a problem with the tub. So it must be, you know, it must be delaminating and it must be a soft tub or, you know, there's lack of rigidity or something somewhere in the system. And
I can only imagine Gary Anderson's response.
Yeah. Yeah. It would have been, It would have been quite a silence. And then probably he would over probably would have just moved on to the next point because he would have realized what the beast that he was dealing with. But the funny story was that a decade later, on the 10th anniversary of Jordan's sort of foundation year, we had a fan event, fan and sponsor event at Donington. So we hired Donington Park for a day.
Did Eddie pay the invoice?
No, because I did the deal with Tom Wheatcroft, and Tom Wheatcroft was fantastic. He said, "Yeah, just come and use the circuit." So we took a bunch of our cars up there. We got our drivers over there. We got lots of sponsors. We set up a marquee. We had a rock concert with all the fans there. We had a fantastic event. It was the EJ10 event. If any of the listeners happen to have remembered that or ever been to it, indeed, I faxed Andrea De Cesaris and said, "Andrea, you wouldn't possibly consider coming over for the EJ10 anniversary. John Watson's going to be there to talk to the fans about his experience driving the 191 on its shakedown test." And Andrea not only came back and said that he would, but when he turned up, he was wearing his Team 7-Up Jordan overalls, which I just thought was everything you needed to know about Andrea De Cesaris, the fan. You know, he was, yes, he was a racing driver, but he just loved what he did. And we had this amazing Q&A with Andrea sitting there in his Team 7-Up Jordan overalls and Watty there. And I can't remember who else. We had the Jarno Trulli and Hans-Harald Frentzen, But at that event, Andrea De Cesaris met Trevor Foster for the first time since the 1991 season.
Wow.
And they got to talking about Michael. And Andrea said, do you remember Spa? And Trevor said, well, of course, you nearly won the race. And he said, yeah, but he said, I said a few things that weekend about Michael's performance. And he said, I was really wrong, wasn't I? it was just, you know, just an acceptance. You know, you can imagine Andrea finally retired from F1 and, you know, sitting at home in Italy. And by 2001, Michael had won 4 world championship titles and should have won a 5th if he hadn't broken his leg at Silverstone. So it was really interesting to...
He was like, that's where the half a second was.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's a tough thing to admit, but the other aspect of that weekend, and, you know, to be fair on Andrea, I think it's important to mention, is that he did nearly win the race. And so while we do talk about Michael and what an amazing debut, and Trevor was terrific. Trevor Foster, for those of you who don't know, he today is heavily involved in running United Autosports, which is Zach Brown's team. And I won't say exactly what age Trevor is now, but all I can say is whatever age he is, he's still 25 and enjoying every moment of going racing. He's just back from the Le Mans 24 Hours at the time of this recording, still loving racing. But his reminiscence about working with Michael, he clearly regards that as a really important, you know, point in his career, being Michael Schumacher's first race engineer. But as I say, then there is this other side to that weekend story, which is that once Michael was unfortunately out of the race due to the clutch problem, and we can, you know, the clutch problem in itself, Ben, as you know from...
Yeah, another
from
great story. Yeah.
Actually, another great story, because when you read about Michael's debut and, oh, he had a clutch problem on the first lap and that was the end of his race, it's so easy to just dismiss that, oh, Jordan had a clutch problem. And actually,
the car let him down, otherwise he would have done this, that, or the other. Yeah, and it's not quite as straightforward as that, is it?
It's not as straightforward as that. And again, please go and read the piece. But there's a really interesting explanation from Trevor as to why the clutch failed and what it was about Michael's absolute focus on getting the most out of the start that led to that happening. But I think, you know, having said what we said about Andrea, he then got himself into a position in that race where he was so determined to outrace Michael. And then with Michael dropping out in the first lap, Andrea then got this momentum going in that race and worked his way up into second place and then was catching Ayrton Senna for the lead. And unfortunately, his Cosworth engine let go, I think it was 5 laps from home, if I recall correctly. And I remember it so vividly because, you know, as press officer, and actually I've just...
Fuji Film press officer.
Fuji Film. Fujifilm press officer. Exactly. As press officer, I needed to go and find Andrea as soon as he had retired from the race. So I kind of made my way down from the top paddock, as it was at Spa, down towards the old paddock, because I knew he would probably come in there on the back of a moped or something with one of the marshals. And sure enough, he turned up and he couldn't even speak to me. He was so frustrated, because could he have overtaken Ayrton? Who knows? But that 191 with Andrea, if he had got onto the rear wing of Senna's McLaren, he would have done everything to find a way past. And I think with the 191, he might have had the capability to do that. And that would have been, I mean, if you can imagine how that would have turned everything for Jordan, for Andrea.
Even not winning would have been massive, wouldn't it?
I mean, even, you know, to have been second. I mean, even just finish second, you know, it would have been extraordinary. But it didn't happen. And it's a great weekend to have been able to look back on in this feature.
Amazing how a driver can get a kick up the backside
by
something like that.
Without a contract being involved.
By shake up like that. Because, you know, it's sometimes... Well, we have these conversations a lot, don't we, about drivers getting too comfortable with their teammates and how sometimes, you know, the struggle that managers of teams have in terms of, do I change my lineup or not? Obviously, in this situation, obviously, it was an enforced change.
Yeah.
But one, obviously, that had a very positive impact. But of course, you know, to bring it up to date, this season we've got, you know, potentially announcements coming and people wrestling with these same kind of things. Do we stick with what we know? Do we twist and deal with the effects of that? But actually it can be quite a positive thing for your incumbent to get the hurry up from someone else. Yes.
Well, I think, you know, and I think if I suspect there are no parallels in terms of the dynamic of what was happening in the team in terms of Andrea, Jordan, Michael. But if you look at Daniel Ricciardo, McLaren, Lando, Norris, and I mean, I seem to have seen quite a lot of commentary during the summer break about the struggles of Daniel Ricciardo, including some of his own comments about where he is or where he isn't in his career at the moment. And again, you're right, Ben, we've talked about this many times before, the whole psychological aspect of a driver, where they are in their career, the confidence they have in themselves, in their car, the way they view the kind of ecosystem in the team that they're in, the degree to which the team is behind them. And you can say you're behind someone, but how does that manifest itself in terms of what's important to them? And, you know, Daniel Ricciardo hasn't forgotten how to be a fast racing driver. And actually, Andrea De Cesaris back in 91 in Spa hadn't forgotten how to be a fast racing driver. But on that weekend up against Michael Schumacher, Michael found extra speed by approaching the car in a different way and playing to the car's strengths. And that was something that Andrea hadn't quite found the magic formula to do. And of course, it goes without saying that, you know, I think we probably suspect that the 191 was never driven by a faster driver before or since. When we look at that season and we say, well, they finished fifth in the World Championship, wasn't that a great effort? Well, what would
we have
done?
There was more there.
There was actually more there to be had, because we were really, you know, excuse my language, but we were really pissing off Benetton Ford. You know.
Yes. Well, people were saying the same about the Benetton, weren't they? That how fast would that car go if it had someone a little bit faster than Roberto Moreno and a little bit more motivated and faster than Nelson Piquet. Do you think, actually, slightly going off piece here, do you think Nelson Piquet is perhaps one of the least rated of the multiple world champions, in that lots and lots of people who are not fans of his say that, well, you know, he had the best car and someone quicker would have done a better job in 83, et cetera, in particular.
Yeah.
87 definitely. I think again, you know, he had knocked himself out and could barely see. So
I think that I mean Nelson's something of an enigma, at least in the way in which he's regarded within the sport. And I think what very much coloured people's view of Nelson was the latter part of his career. He had arguably had his moment in the sun, and we had seen the best of him. And there was an aura around Nelson because he had become part of that super league of drivers in Formula One in the mid-1980s. And that had quite a long tail to it. You could argue that you can definitely say Nigel should have absolutely retired from Formula One earlier.
Yes.
Than he did. You can say that Nelson should have retired from Formula One earlier than he did. There was a tendency to stick around a little bit longer than they should have. And I think that then ultimately had an impact on, I mean, Nigel Mansell must get fed up with people making jokes about, you know, his comeback at McLaren and how that didn't work out. He should never have done it. And, you know, we should actually just discount that. It's just, you know, at some point, a lot of very successful drivers look at coming back at, you know, into Formula One and having a tryout. And it's often embarrassing because they have, you know, whatever was there has been lost. And I mean, I read a piece this week about, you know, Didier Pironi trying to come back into Formula One. He had a secret test at Dijon, in a Renault, and René Arnoux was there to watch him sort of trying to come back. And literally on that day in that test, Didier Pironi realized it was over. It was over for him. He had never recovered from his injuries. And, you know, Mika Hakkinen has told me about testing the McLaren Lamborghini. Do you remember that?
We even carried a photo of it.
Yeah. And, you know, Mika looked at coming back. But actually, so sometimes at the end of a driver's career is played out very publicly, and that can be difficult. That can leave a sour taste. You know, we talked about Damon Hill just before the podcast recording, and I mean, Damon, I think in his autobiography, talks about his final season in Formula One 1999 with Jordan, and you know, certainly the latter half of that season, he really just should not have bothered racing. He didn't want to be there anymore, and he should just have gone home. So I think with Nelson Piquet, there was something of a similar thing that could be said. But of course he had a lot of support around him. He had people like Bernie who were big fans of his, and you know, keeping his career going because he was a world champion and all of that. But yes, Jordan definitely with the 191, we had a giant killing opportunity and maybe didn't quite extract that from the car.
But of course, Nelson was the next driver to receive the wake up call from Michael.
Yeah, sure.
At the very next race.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, Michael, you know, in joining Benetton, he stepped into the team that was in front of us in the Constructors' World Championship, and there was so much politics to that move. I mean, again, when I was talking to Trevor, we were talking about the fact that we had, at the beginning of the season, we'd been a step behind the Works Ford team, Benetton team, in terms of our engine. So we had like a Series 3 Ford HB V8 engine instead of a Series 4. And then we finally got the Series 4. And we had the Series 4 in Spa. And my recollection of that was that the Series 4 increase wasn't that big a step. But Trevor reminded me that gave us an extra 750 RPM. That's a big chunk. And although there wasn't a lot of power in that extra 750 RPM, it actually enabled us to play with the gearing. And it just gave us a lot more, as Trevor said, gave us more tools to play with.
Yeah, it's more usable, isn't it?
It's more usable.
More flexible.
And, you know,
less likely for the drivers to buzz the engine.
Yeah, I mean, less likely, exactly. And, you know, this is, I mean, again, to put it into perspective for those listening, that, you know, we're all used these days to talking about a Formula One, which eventually got to a 20,000 RPM engine speed. And actually, the Cosworth CAA engine did 22,000 RPM on the dyno in testing. But back in 1991, Formula One engines still had fully mechanical valves. So we didn't have pneumatic valve systems. We had spring or twin spring or Y-spring valves. Like we had double spring valves at the time. And so you're looking at mechanical systems, and that HB V8 engine was revving to, you know, 13,000 RPM, which is a big RPM for mechanical systems in those days to operate at. And that, again, that's why the over rev was so critical, because if you buzzed it to, you know, 13.4 or 13.6, well, there was a good chance that those springs weren't much use anymore.
Yeah. Wasn't it? And did Andrea buzz an engine, or did he lose the lead of the race? I think he avoided buzzing the engine, but he lost the lead of a race. Was it Long Beach in the Alfa Romeo? He took his hand off the wheel to shake his fist at Bruno Giacomelli, or was it Raul Bozzel? Some tugger in a back of the grid car held him up, and he was, you know, shaking his fist and giving it all that, and Niki Lauda just overtook him. just off the top of my head.
I think there are so many. I mean, actually, there is. It's just such a shame Andrea is no longer with us, because when you know, if you're listening to the official Formula One podcasts and some of the retrospectives, you know, where they get drivers from yesteryear, it'd be so great to have Andrea come on, because, you know, he drove for so many teams in Formula One. He crashed so many cars in Formula One. He almost bankrupted, Ron Dennis because he crashed so many tubs that year. But the reality is that he made a big contribution, and he was a great racer. And I think it's a shame that we lost him at such a young age in that motorcycle accident.
How much was Jordan undone by a bit of naivety in the whole political shenanigans that took Schumacher so quickly from car driver to his Benetton future?
Did Eddie sort of, because Michael was just a in theory a pay driver who came with this suitcase full of cash, do you think Eddie maybe didn't scrutinize the small print of the contract quite as much as he could have done if he thought he had a hot shot on his hands?
I don't think there was naivety. I think there was pressure. There was pressure to get the deal done, and the contract for Michael to actually race the car, and I think I talk about this in the article, is that the contract wasn't actually signed until the Thursday. So even when we arrived in Spa, the contract wasn't done, and there were different parties involved. Obviously, there was Jochen Nierpasch at Sauber Mercedes sports car program. There was Willy Weber as Michael's manager. And it all really turned on one word in the contract, which was, lots of contracts, you either have an agreement or you don't have an agreement. And a kind of a middle way is to start talking about using your best intentions, or there's an intention, or there's of course, the problem is the contract that got signed was very much an intention to sign a future contract. It just didn't bind it up strongly enough. And so I don't think that was naivety. I think that the other thing is that Eddie didn't have a crystal ball. He didn't know how that weekend was going to go. He was pretty hopeful that he would retain Michael if he wanted to. I think it's really unfortunate, isn't it, that because the Jordan 191 was so good, Michael was able to really show his capability, and all of a sudden you have Tom Walkinshaw, Flavio Briatore, and Bernie Eccleston, actually, all over this deal. And I think if there was naivety, it was in the degree to which the likes of a Tom Walkinshaw, a Flavio Briatore, and a Bernie Eccleston could work together to achieve an outcome. And in this case, to get a superstar young driver into the Benetton Ford team as soon as possible. And of course, that was the right thing for them to be doing. They understood their racing and they understood their deals, and they were able to have one over on Jordan that way. But again, as I relate in the piece, ultimately they all came down to Roberto Moreno, because what happened was there were a couple of court cases. There was a court case in London, and then there was a court case in Milan. The Jordan court case in London didn't succeed, but the court case in Milan did succeed, and that was Roberto Moreno being able to demonstrate that he had a binding contract at Benetton, and there were no conditions under which Benetton could just kick him out arbitrarily for the next race. So Roberto could simply have continued to drive for the rest of that season, and Michael wouldn't have had a seat to jump into. So really what happened in that meeting at Villa d'Este in the run-up to the Italian Grand Prix was that Roberto Moreno was told, by Tom Walkinshaw and Flavio Briatore that, yes, you have a contract with us and you have won this court case, you could stay on the team, but actually we don't want you. And so the question is, do you want to drive for a team that doesn't want you anymore? And on top of that, we know who we do want. We want Michael. And then the final, sort of the pièce de résistance was they said to Roberto, and by the way, we'll pay you off. And, you know, Eddie and Ian were very keen that Roberto didn't get a payoff, and they were like, stick to your guns and keep your drive at Benetton. And Roberto was like, well, you know, it's not often that someone offers you $500,000 in one go. And that's what he got. He got $500,000. And he
imagine left. The number of rebuilds he could have afforded with that.
Yeah, exactly. And he left, you know, he took the money, he left Benetton, he drove for Jordan, and then
so he spaffed all that money away very quickly.
Well, that's actually, that's one of the reasons he didn't continue with Jordan for the rest of the season, because he stepped into the car, and obviously Eddie needed to have money to pay for the drive for the balance
your lunch.
Of the season. Yeah, to pay for my lunch, my incredibly expensive bowl of pesto pasta, you know, which
washed down by a bottle of Margaux by the sounds of that.
Yeah, 10 out of 10, Eddie, for the creativity, financial creativity that went into all of that process. But yes, it was, and you know, I think I may have sort of mentioned this on the previous podcast, but again, when, you know, people do talk to me about the 1991 season, about Michael's debut at Spa. It is just so tragic that we're sitting here today, and that Michael and Alexander Zanardi, you know, two of our drivers that season, have suffered such profound life-changing injuries in what they subsequently went on, you know, to do. And in Michael's case, you know, on the skiing trip, and in Alex's case, you know, after everything else that he's been through, to suffer an accident, you know, while out on his bicycle. And yeah, you know, so I look back on that year in lots of different ways, and think about those guys who are still with us, but obviously afflicted with what's happened to them. And then poor Andrea losing his life. So yeah, it was quite a momentous year.
Yeah. Oh, you have to take your opportunity to speak to these people when you can, can't you? Because you say a lot of these voices no longer with us, and the longer time goes on, the fewer the people there are around to speak to. Although, yeah. Returning to Roberto Moreno for a moment, and now there's someone who likes to talk about 1991, because when Renault bought Benetton, it's coming up to 20 years ago now. Yeah, one of my first jobs when I joined F1 Racing, as it was known then, was to phone a load of the previous drivers of Benetton to, you know, to reminisce about their experiences as we closed the door on that final chapter of the team as it became Renault the following season. And I lucked in first to speak to Emanuele Pirro, who charm personified, before he got onto the subject of what a bar steward Flavio Briatore was, and that took a little bit of time. Then he said to me, Stuart, do not write this. Do not write this. Please say I only have the fond memories of my time at Benetton. Do not say this about Flavio. Do not say. No. He's just for you and me. I then phoned Roberto Moreno, and dear God, I was on the phone for an hour, 55 minutes of which he devoted to a full and frank unparceling of what he thought of Flavio Briatore. And he was on the phone for so long, my ear was sweating. The then editor of the magazine was cheekily writing notes that he then put under my nose, saying, hey, get him on a book deal. So yeah, he's still quite angry about it. And I mean, that was quite a politically charged weekend, wasn't it? The weekend after the Belgian Grand Prix,
yeah, though,
for ahead of Monza, because
yeah,
we in parades this month, we have a special of pictures devoted to that time, 1991, Michael Schumacher's debut, and curated by Stephen T, who absolutely loved presiding over these things. And one of the images, which Steve said, technically, it's not a great image. The lighting's crap, and it's on ektachrome, so the colours are crap. but it's a fascinating image of Willy Weber with his Louis Vuitton briefcase making a break, legging it out the paddock into a helicopter, followed by Michael and Flavio Briatore. And what I don't think Steve liked Tom Walkinshaw very much. He said, you know, the best thing is that Tom is almost out of shot, and all you can see is the shoulder of the jacket he's carrying on a coat hanger, and they're all desperately trying to lug it out of there. And Michael particularly has a face like a bruised lemon. He's clearly not wanting to speak to anyone else. And doesn't like the fact that Rainer Schlegelmilch has gone in there with, I think, a 50mm camera. So he's had to go in quite tight into the little group. And that's the thing that most amused Steve. He's sort of like, not only is it like crap and he's gone in there with his crap film, but he's gone and stuck his lens right in them when they don't want to be seen and they don't want to talk to him.
Can I also interject on that anecdote and just say that, you know, if Stephen had been using Fujifilm and not Ektachrome, he would have been a much...
Steve said it should have been on Velvia. Let me tell you, Connors, I always shot on Velvia because the colours are so much better. Michael was big news because I'd help Steve out with some of his recollections of where he might have been standing for a couple of places, and so I rewatched part of the Italian Grand Prix, which happened to be on YouTube in the RTL coverage, and ye gods, you'd have thought there was no one but Michael Schumacher in that race in only his second Grand Prix. You know, he was big news for the German market.
Yeah, it was massive, and probably shouldn't spoil the feature for readers too much, but I mean, I mentioned the fact that it was that weekend which gave rise to the infamous Ron Dennis Piranha Club statement to Eddie Jordan. Because I think Eddie, you know, having said what I said about the fact, I don't think he was naive, but I think he certainly learned a lot that weekend about just how far people were prepared to push things, and that contracts in Formula One were all out for open to negotiation. Money could lubricate pretty well anything that you wanted to achieve. And I think he learned a lot from that. And ultimately he went on to become a very good practitioner of becoming a pretty efficient piranha in the pond, which you need to do in order to survive in what is a pretty cutthroat business, particularly for an independent team.
Yeah, because obviously we have the 191 in the studio for our Now That Was a Car feature, and one of the claims that came up while we were looking for some hitherto unseen facts to research that was how close did that car actually come to never seeing the light of day? Because there was talk when the money was running scarce, wasn't there, of maybe doing a tie up with Lotus.
That was a year previous.
When the car was still in development.
Yeah, when the car was still in. So Eddie did try to do a deal to buy Team Lotus. And, of course, that's so one of the other features in the magazine that we'll talk about is I interviewed Mika Häkkinen about his sojourn at Team Lotus in 91 and 92. But, you know, when Team Lotus entered that sort of latter stages of its history, Eddie could see there was an opportunity there, and also there was a link through Camel, because Camel had sponsored Eddie Jordan Racing in Formula 3000, which again was a brilliant deal that Eddie pulled off, against all the odds. And Camel had been sponsoring Team Lotus, so Eddie felt that effectively he could convince Camel to back him in taking over Team Lotus in a similar way to Marlborough backing Ron Dennis to take over McLaren a decade earlier. So it was kind of that approach, but it didn't work out. And again, Eddie put everything on the line himself without Camel backing. He put everything on the line to build the first Jordan 191 in the summer of 1990, early autumn, and get it out and test it. And I think that was the best thing that he ever did, because lots of prospective Formula One team owners and team bosses will show you a PowerPoint presentation or slides or a nice brochure. You know, if you give me all this money, I'll go and build this car. Eddie did it the other way around. He built the car. And when you have a physical product that you can show people and they can see that you've you know, you've made that step. The fact that we only could afford to build one car was at that time neither here nor there, you know, but that's what we went and did, and we tested it. And then it meant that the likes of Fujifilm and Marlboro, who sponsored both Andrea and Bertrand and 7-Up, they could actually see something tangible. So this
serious
is not a
intent. Serious intent.
He could have lost his shirt on the whole thing if he hadn't gotten the funding, but he was determined to do it, and he did make it happen. And I think, you know, as you know, all joking aside, yes, I mean, the lessons he learned, he did become a very astute operator in Formula One. He made a huge amount of money out of Formula One over the next 15 years. And that's what you get if you put everything on the line, it pays off.
It's interesting. You mentioned the your Mika interview, that he spent a lot of time in the wilderness, didn't he? And he and Michael had been rivals in Formula Three. There was that sort of little incident in Macau, and they went on to become great rivals in Formula One as well. But for a long time, they inhabited different ends of the grid, and Mika was laboring in back of the grid machinery while Michael was sort of in his pomp, really. And that Lotus just, it was quite a shocker, wasn't it? It improved once they got a better engine, but I'm surprised that Mika entertained the notion of driving a car with the Lamborghini again after that season.
Yeah. I mean, he had an opportunity, as he relates in the piece, he had this opportunity to drive for Team Lotus, and, you know, Keke Rosberg being his manager, as well as a prospective Jordan 191 driver.
I'm going to be racing against you, Mika.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, how beautiful would that have been? So, you know, a phone call from your manager to say, so, by the way, I've just out-qualified you.
Has it ever happened?
Has it ever happened? That would have been such a neat story, wouldn't it? Anyway, but, yes, so Keke, obviously managing, and Keke and Didier Coton, who is today, of course, manager of Valtteri Bottas. And, you know, so together they were advising Mika, and they knew they needed to make the breakthrough to F1. They knew that Team Lotus didn't have a lot of funding, but it was an opportunity. And Peter Collins needed money to make it happen. So that, again, everyone was in the business of in the small teams of trying to find drivers with funding. And this is where Keke really came into his own, because he had built a formidable reputation at home in Finland. He was able to go and strike deals with companies like Neste Oil, and of course Marlboro, and other people were able to come in. So they basically put together a patchwork quilt of a deal with funding from lots of different sources to ease Mika's way into that seat. And I think it was in full recognition of the fact that it wasn't going to be a competitive drive, and that Peter Collins had his heart very much behind the other guy who would ultimately drive the car, which is Johnny Herbert, because he'd, you know, been a big supporter of Johnny all the way through from, you know, Formula 3000 days, and he gave him his original opportunity at Benetton. And, you know, talking about Flavio earlier on, I mean, Peter, listening to Peter Collins's views of Flavio recently in the official Formula One podcast, I mean, he doesn't hold back either, and talks about the fact that he couldn't work with someone with Flavio's ethics, which was
hopefully not for as long as Roberto Moreno.
He made a pretty pointed comment about that. But anyway, you know, Peter Collins needed the money to run that team. In Mika, he had a cracking driver who was bringing a budget. Again, why wouldn't you sign him off the back of what he'd achieved in Formula 3? And, you know, he came in and he did the job that he did. And, you know, the thing that I loved about the Mika piece was, I mean, it's a very small thing in some ways, but I'd had the pleasure of meeting and working with Julian Bailey when he was a Formula One driver. And he's long kind of since forgotten as being a Formula One driver from Britain. But, you know, Julian worked his backside off to get into Formula One, and he was quite a talented driver. And Mika actually talks about how, I mean, he talked to me at some length about how great Julian was to work with. And, of course, they had that result in Imola, which is actually Julian's only points finish. where they both got into the points. I talk about the fact it was a race of the minnows. You know, all the small teams had a fantastic result. JJ Leto on the, I think he was on the podium for Scuderia Italia.
Eric Van der Poel got a point in the Lambo, but it blew up two laps from the end.
And you know, it was just great. And Mika really enjoyed reminiscing about that. And I mean, he said to me he can count the number of interviews that he's given about his time at Team Lotus on the finger of one finger, because everyone, you know.
Well, this is what I was hoping for when we talked about it. I wanted some of the obscurity to be lifted.
Well, I think
because everyone's going to talk to Häkkinen about Spa and Schumacher and McLaren and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's been done to death, hasn't it? But
so, well, that's exactly what happened. I phoned him and I said, Mika, so I needed an interview with you. And he went, oh, yes, about winning the world championship. I said, no, I said, I needed an interview with you about Team Lotus. And he said, why?
And hopefully no one else asked that question when they see it in the magazine.
So I said to him, it's because we want to put your feature wheel to wheel with the Michael Schumacher feature, which I'm doing. So I said, you're in a wheel to wheel feature battle with Michael Schumacher. Yeah. So you've got to come up with better stories.
So we naturally go straight to Johnny Herbert, trying to get him to share a bath.
Exactly. But I thought that was great. And actually, you know, he loved talking about the fact that there was, you know, no money in the team. And so he had to share a room with Johnny Herbert, and they had to share a bathroom. And, you know, you just kind of think about all of those, you know, this would all be unthinkable. I mean, I'm just trying to get my head around Sergio Perez, you know, walking into the shower and having Max standing there saying, would you like to join me? So
I'll put 50p in. It might be coming afterwards.
And so
he was good value, wasn't he, Mika? I got the impression that he enjoyed that.
Yeah, interview. I think. Yeah, Mika does often talk about the fact that he had to wait 7 years to win his first Grand Prix. And actually, one of the things he's talked to me about a few times over the last few years, while people have been really caning Valtteri Bottas and criticizing him at every opportunity, is Mika says, well, you know, it took me 7 years to win. I did point out to him he didn't have a Mercedes-Benz to drive. So, you know, it was a little bit different. But his point is that success doesn't always come overnight. You have to build up to it. And yes, I think it was a very painful experience for him to see Michael go on, particularly Michael's first two world championships, you know, the 94-95 titles. You know, Mika was, you know, he'd just come into McLaren. He came into McLaren as a test driver. Of course, he then took over from Michael Andretti. And then they just had, really a tough time in that middle part of the 1990s with engine deals that didn't work out. And they were kind of floundering around. It was kind of in a similar way to what McLaren had just been through over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, a team that you come out of a purple patch where you've had really strong partnerships. And then all of a sudden you have to rediscover a package. And it's not easy to unplug one package and plug in something else. You're not going to immediately pick up where you left off. So I think those were tough enough years. But the thing is that Ron Dennis really rated Mika and didn't lose faith in him. And it would be interesting. I would love to talk to Mika and Ron one day about, if I had the opportunity, I'd love to talk to the two of them about the whole dynamic which occurred in the wake of Mika's accident in Adelaide in 95, because people have said to me, I'm going to say people, I mean David Coulthard, people have said to me that Mika changed after that accident, and that he somehow became more fearless, and that whatever he had before was that the volume got turned up in terms of his speed. And so he went from being very good to really great. And that's really an interesting moment. And the fact that Ron...
That's very unusual as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very unusual. And so rather than knocking the edge off him, it took him into a different place, a different zone in terms of his mindset. And it's particularly interesting when you consider that Mika then subsequently ended his career early, in his early 30s, because he was concerned about hurting himself, and he had a couple of incidents happen, which, you know, early in 2002, which caused him to realize that he was taking too many risks. So it's not that he became risk averse at that point after the accident. It happened much, much later on after he won his world championship title. So, but also the flip side of that is not only did Mika go to another level, but Ron was prepared to go with him. And, you know, Mika has talked to me about that first test after the accident, and he really wasn't sure how that would work out. How would he feel about driving a Formula One car only a few months after it almost cost him his life and all the trauma that he had suffered as a result of that. But also the fact that Ron kept the support going there. And then ultimately they built something pretty formidable and went on to win those championship titles. So yeah, really, you know, again, we keep coming back to this topic, don't we, about the psychology of it and the interaction of team bosses and drivers and the faith that they have in each other. And, you know, if you get the human element right, somehow the technical side becomes a lot easier.
I wonder if you do end up asking him about this, whether not going back to Adelaide made a difference. Because you have this idea that, you know, to conquer a fear, you go back and face it. So
yeah,
driving the same circuit again, then you'd realize, you know, how you truly felt about what happened, yeah, whether you'd overcome it. But I also know of drivers who, when they go back to a circuit where they've witnessed something really devastating or experienced something really horrific, yeah, it affects them at a deep level. So when they get to that same place, it all comes back almost subconsciously. And they can't do what they did before. And then maybe that manifests elsewhere, because once you've had that one seed of doubt, it sprouts in other places that you didn't realize. So I'd be interested in if it was just almost like a closed loop already, because he went in, it happened, and he never went back.
He closed that chapter. Well, at the moment, I as you guys know, have a good affiliations with Adelaide, and there's a big motorsport week in Adelaide every year. So they've lost the 500 Australian V8 touring car event, which was the Clipsal 500. So that's no longer part of the makeup in South Australia. But they have this big classic motorsport event, which involves there's a rally and there's a touring sort of high speed touring event, and they do a lot of events in Adelaide. And they're really keen to get Mika to come back to Adelaide and do that. And we're currently working on a package to see if I can make that happen, because I know Mika would love to go back to Adelaide. He did a fabulous message to the General Hospital there a couple of years ago at Christmas time, thanking everyone, saying, you know, he often thinks about the care that he had and at the General Hospital there, it saved his life. And it'd be great to get him to go back and maybe to reminisce about that. And exactly to your point, Ben, you know, he probably never has been back to the track, or indeed to that wall, which he hit as a result of the puncture. And be interesting to take him back and talk to him about it.
I think that's got winter feature written all over it. get it in the content the forward features list.
There's a small matter of the fact that Australia's borders are closed currently. Yeah. And
we'll do it in the winter of 2025.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be,
it can go on the spike until then.
Yeah.
We've got patience.
20 years, 20th anniversary of your biggest crash feature.
It's also interesting. Do you think there's an element?
Wow. 30th.
Oh, God,
We're older than we think.
Yeah, we are.
Well, yeah, I've been thinking, you know, obviously the summer of 1991, I was about to go to university. I know, you know, Ben, you were in short trousers, but to complete, I was in slightly longer short trousers, but to complete my thought on Mika, maybe there's a difference between having a shunt when the world championship is something you think you can have in the future and having a few big shunts when you've already got two world championships in the bag and you kind of think, well, do you know, I'm getting a bit too old for this, and I've done the hard yards and I've got the silverware. So who knows, maybe that's worth bringing up in a feature that we may be able to action in the coming months. Yeah. Who knows? You know, Mika is still enjoying life working with you, doing all these corporate speakings from his garage on his iPad, etc.
Yeah.
Well, we have run over time, so you know, at the risk of it's obviously marvellous to have these excellent reminiscences and talk about the latest issue of GP Racing. However, I am told we have to wind this in and allow our producer to excise all the litigious bits.
That's the entire Flavio Briatore piece taken out then.
So, without further ado, obviously GP Racing is landing very shortly on the newsstands, if not right away, depending on when this podcast is published, after we've had our lunches, etc. Thank you very much, Mark Gallagher, for your time today, and for your stentorian work on in our features this month. It's been fascinating reading Two of the Stars of 1991.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. We've managed a full podcast without any child or cat intervention. So
things are looking good, aren't they?
Things are looking up. Yes, so go to gpracing.com to read all the latest subscriber offers. And with luck, you might even be able to fill out a direct debit mandate if they fix the back end by the time this podcast goes up. And we'll be back next month with another Flat Chat. Thanks for listening.